Hello everyone, Felicia here, making a quick recording before we get into the episode. So Julia and I took the time to record the episode, and I was fumbling with a lot of the pronunciation of certain things. At first I thought, you know what, it is what it is. That's a really lazy attitude to have. I've taken the time to re-record better pronunciation of certain words in Korean. So if you hear a little discrepancy how certain words sound at different points, and also I didn't want to make Julia have to sit through an entire re-recording. Have memories of this clip if you find yourself being annoyed with the discrepancy between the sound quality.
Hi, kids! Welcome to Camp Krusty! I'll see you in a few weeks. Until then, I've turned things over to my bestest buddy in the whole wide world.
Mr. Black.
I want you to treat
Mr. Black
with the same respect you would give me. Now here's
Mr. Black.
So, without further ado, enjoy the episode. Welcome to the Royal Diaries, Unlocking History. My name is Felicia.
My name is Julia. We are sisters who love books, history, and talking about them both.
We're doing a deep dive into the Royal Diaries series.
Come with us as we learn about the girls who became women that shaped history.
All right, we're back with a vengeance.
Is it a vengeance, though?
No vengeance, but we're back.
We are back.
We are in season two, and we're kicking off with Sondok, Princess of the Moon and Stars by Sherry Holman. The summary says, in a series of messages placed in her grandmother's ancestral jar, a 6th century princess and future ruler of the Korean kingdom of Silla vents her frustrations at not being permitted to study astronomy because she is a girl.
Ooh.
So, Silla, not Silla.
Silla. I mean, it looks like a Silla, so if I mess that up, I'm really sorry.
Straight up, Korean language-wise, pronunciation-wise, I do not know enough.
Yeah.
So, very genuine forgiveness. I will do my best. So, what did you think about Sondok? Reading it the first time, reading it again?
So, I remember reading this book and enjoying it a lot. And then reading it again now that I'm older. This book freaking slaps.
I was going to say this.
It is a slap till the end of time.
I enjoyed this book. You know what? When I sat down to read it, some of this feels vaguely familiar, but not enough of it stood out to me a lot.
Mm.
But in this reread, my goodness, remember how I just kept saying my only complaint about Nzinga was I wish this book was longer?
Mm-hmm.
This book is the perfect length, and her characterization, it reminded me very much of Nzinga, where she's a young girl being trained actually as the heir, because in so many others mm-hmm. of the situations, it's, well, you're probably not going to come to the throne.
Yeah.
She's when she's actually going to come to the throne, and so many good instances that push-pull between being a traditional good little daughter versus, no, you got to be a ruler. It was just an amazing book.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed this book. This might actually, so far, be my new fave.
I think it might be actually up there for me, too, in terms of faves. One thing, though, is that for me, I remember more in details about this book, though, going into it. I remembered what happened with her mom.
Mm.
I remembered how the astronomy factored in, like, how it became from a topic into a theme and all of that type of thing.
Yeah.
I remembered quite a bit about it. And so then, like, rereading it, there was a deeper appreciation. This book slaps. This is the only book, I think, that we've read where I need to go and put, like, an
sticky tabs.
Because if I do not go and share, like, some points that I really enjoyed about it, I would be disappointed in myself.
Fair enough. I wonder if one of your standout things that you're going to share is the one that stood out to me that I really appreciated was at one point her mom has to oversee the silkworms.
Mm-hmm.
Even though she's a queen and an empress, it's women's work. So mm-hmm. she has to oversee this process. And Sondok obviously doesn't want to do this. What a waste of my time.
Mm-hmm.
But then she writes this very poignant thing of that push-pull of being, I want to reject doing woman things because I don't want to be just held into a box. But at the same time, I appreciate them. I don't know what to do.
I don't know why I hate women's work so much, Grandmother. Logically, I know there is nothing shameful in it, but somehow I feel that if I do what is expected of me as a woman, I will lose the little insecure foothold I have in the world of men. I sometimes feel torn between acting like a daughter to my mother and a son to my father. By nature, my flesh is weak, yet through my will, I must toughen it to govern this kingdom up upon my father's death. Maybe that Mu Dang was right. I am a tree without roots.
That passage right there, when I was rereading this book, I just sat there for like a moment. This fake diary entry girl is speaking to me, not just past me as a child. Still to this day, this passage speaks to me.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so good.
I think that this is one of the things where some of these books are definitely more well-written than others. Mm. Whereas we've talked about how do you go and integrate historical knowledge? How do you go and integrate what day-to-day life was like? The thing is that she does not just those two things, but she really knows how to go and actually address some meaningful concerns about subject positioning. There are actual themes in this book that are actually quite well realized, and it's quite dense in that way. There are a lot of threads going on here that culminate quite beautifully. It's just a very well-written book.
Yeah, it ties together very nicely.
Mm-hmm.
What was the other passage that stood out to you that you put your sticky tab in?
Nothing in Mother's life has prepared her for this sort of betrayal. She has always spent her days dutifully tending the silkworms, weaving and overseeing the kitchen and storehouses. She has been an exemplary wife in all ways but one. It is so unfair, Grandmother. It's just like, yeah, you can do everything right, so to speak, but again, patriarchy knows no time and it knows like no borders.
Yeah, exactly.
And so it doesn't matter who you are if because you are unable to go and do one thing, which is, of course, giving a son.
Make that baby boy.
Yeah. And I think it's terrible. It's just terrible.
Well, and it's talk about no time, place and blah, blah, blah. The most infamous can't give the boy and pays the price for it is Anne Boleyn, so Elizabeth the First mom.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just
Henry VIII striving to have a son, and even Mary, Queen of Scots, too, with her and her whole seeking of an heir and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's like how a woman's body can never go and exist within itself. It always will be part of a larger socio-political project.
Yeah.
No matter what.
I really appreciated this book. I really liked it, enjoyed it. This one landed really well in terms of showing character growth and development,
mm-hmm.
too, which felt very natural.
Yeah.
And didn't feel forced. I really felt like I got to know Sondag as a person and not just as a historical figure, which was nice because sometimes part of that may have been on the flip side, we have it where there isn't a lot of documentation about the person. So it's up to the writer to really do the heavy lift and fill in a lot of gaps. Mm-hmm. So like with Lady of Chao Ku or, you know, even Cleopatra, you don't have nothing from their youth, you know,
yeah.
So it's really trying to fill in the blanks that way. Sondag's very much the same, but I think that she was very successful in that, okay, I don't have a lot of historical stuff to go on, but what can I do telling a story-wise,
mm-hmm.
moving this girl through this stuff?
Definitely.
So the way I'm going to do this is that peppered throughout my bio of her, we're going to explore different doors.
So, different doors?
Yes. So imagine yourself in a room and there are 5 doors in front of you. And along the way, we'll leave the story of Sondag and we will open a door and I will tell you about a part that relates to something about her life. And then we'll come back to Sondag.
Okay, I'll try not to get lost.
Don't worry, I'll remind you when we're going back to Sondag. But just because playing with the form, it is one of those things, how to give all this information that there are a couple of things in this book that was, huh, that's pretty interesting. I wonder if I could find a bit more about that.
Mm.
So this is where I've done these sort of little bit deeper dives on that. On that note, I literally kicked this off by saying, not much is known about Queen Sondag's early life, but we do know that she was born Princess Dikomen in 606 to King Jinpeon, the 26th king of Shilla, and his first queen, Maya. Although some of Jinpeon's royal concubines had sons, neither of his official queens produced a surviving boy. Princess Dikomen was well known for her intelligence and accomplishments, and according to the surviving historical documents, one story tells the time of when the Emperor Taizong of Tang China sent a sample of poppy seeds and a painting of flowers to the Shilla court, and Dikomen predicted that the flowers in the picture would have no scent. When they bloomed, the poppies were indeed odorless, and the princess explained that there were no bees or butterflies in the painting, hence her prediction that the blossoms wouldn't be fragrant.
Were they poppies or were they peonies?
In this book, they write peonies, which was strange to me because when it says peonies have no scent, I'm like, that is a lie because I like burying my face in a peony. They smell delicious. So in this, it was poppies. Which tracks because poppies don't make a scent. And also, think about Asiatic flowers. I think the reason why she might have chosen to use a peony is because a peony is really important in Korean culture. But I don't like they have a scent.
Well, and also, what do you associate poppies with as well? Most people within the Western context, it's poppies are for Remembrance Day.
That or, you know, it's the opium trade, but...
Yeah, that too. Cool.
So door number one is the Kingdom of Shilla. The Shilla Kingdom is one of Korea's three kingdoms, along with the Pekche Kingdom and the Kokuryo Kingdom. Shilla was based in the southeastern of the Korean Peninsula, while
Pekche
controlled the southwest and Kokuryo in the north. So Korea is a peninsula. Mm-hmm. It hangs out off of Manchuria, China area.
Yeah.
And so in this time, the Northern Kingdom of Korea actually pressed pretty far into Northern China. So you had these three kingdoms and Shilla was the smallest. The name appears on the records of Yatomo Japanese and the Jurchens, as well as ancient Korean documents. Japanese sources named the people of Shilla as the Shiragai, while the Jurchens or Manchus referred to them as the Solho. Shilla was founded in 57 BCE by King Park Haegyos. Legend says that Park hatched from an egg that was laid by a chicken dragon. Interestingly, he's considered to be the progenitor of all Koreans with the family name Park. So it's a very common last name.
The more you know.
The more you know. So for most of his history, however, the kingdom was ruled by members of the Gangju branch of the Kim family. The Shilla kingdom would survive for nearly 992 years, making it one of the longest sustained dynasties in human history.
Dang.
However, the dynasty was actually ruled by members of three different families in the early centuries. The Kim family held power for more than 600 years, though it still qualifies as one of the longest known dynasties. So, the more you know.
Oh, okay. So, like, they're all technically, like, related. It just passes down through. And, like, kind of like how, like, the Plantagenets weren't actually all the Plantagenets, but we all know they were the Plantagenets.
Very much so.
Okay.
So, it's not like in China where it passes from the Sui dynasty to the Tang dynasty to the da-da. Even though it's different families, it's all considered part of the Shilla kingdom dynasty.
Okay.
So that's why it's like one of the longest dynasties. By the early 500s, early Shilla had grown into a proper kingdom. It formally adopted Buddhism as a state religion in 527. Together with its ally,
Pekche,
Shilla pushed the Kokuryo north out of the area around the Han River, now where Seoul is. And it went on to break more than a century-long alliance with
Pekche.
In 553, grabbing control of the Han River region, Shilla would then annex the Gaya Confederacy in 562. And in 654, King Mayo formed an alliance with the Tang Dynasty in China. And in 660, he conquered
Pekche,
and his successor conquered
Kokuryo
in 668, bringing the entire Korean peninsula under Shilla domination. Among the many accomplishments in the unified kingdom was the first example of printing. A Buddhist sutra produced with woodblock printing has been discovered at a temple. It was printed in 751 CE and is the earliest printed document ever found.
Dang.
Beginning in the 800s, Shilla fell into decline. Increasingly powerful nobles threatened the power of the kings. Military rebellions centered on strongholds in the other kingdoms. Finally, in 935, the last king of unified Shilla surrendered to the emerging Kokuryo kingdom to the north. former Shilla capital city of Gangju still features impressive historical sites from this ancient period. Although the most popular are the Punggut-sun temple with its stone Buddha figure, the Tulmi Park features the burial mounds of the Shilla kings, and there's still astronomical observatories. So what was happening at this point with Shilla, it was a small kingdom, but it was smart in terms of its alliances. The kingdom recognized, I'll partner with the other small kingdom and we'll push out the northern one. And then what ended up happening is that then Shilla turned around and was like, oh, hey, I'm now going to partner with China to take over my former ally so we can take over the entire thing. So very much like a chess match, 100% of do not play Risk with these people.
That sounds like the plot of Jawbreaker. Just a bit.
It could be. So that is the door number one, the kingdom of Shilla. Back to Queen Sondok. As the oldest child of a queen and a young woman of great intellectual power, Princess Dikomen was selected to be her father's successor. In Shilla culture, a family's heritage was traced through the matrilineal and patrilineal sides in the bone rank system, giving highborn women more authority than any other culture at the time. Because of this, it was not unknown for a woman to rule over small sections in the Shilla kingdom, but they had only ever served as regents for sons or dowager queens, never in their own name. This changed when King Jaepyeong died in 632 and his 26-year-old daughter Princess Dikomen became the first ever outright female monarch known as Queen Sondok.
Nice.
Door number two, the bone rank system. The bone rank or gold plum system was developed in the Shilla kingdom during the 5th and 6th centuries. The designation of a person's hereditary bone rank signified how closely they were related to royalty, thus what rights and privileges they had in society. The highest rank of bone was Seonggal or sacred bone that made up of people who were from the royal family on both sides. Originally, only one sacred bone rank person could become king or queen. The second rank was true bone or Jin Gal and consisted of people of royal blood on one side of the family and noble blood on the other. Below these bone ranks were head ranks 6, 5, 4. Head rank 6 men could hold high ministerial and military posts, while members of the head rank 4 could only become lower level bureaucrats. Interestingly enough, historical sources never mention head ranks 3, 2, and 1. Perhaps they were the ranks of the common people who didn't have government office, therefore they didn't merit mention in the government documents. The bone rank system was a rigid caste system. People were expected to marry within their bone rank, although some higher rank men could have concubines from lower ranks.
Of course.
The sacred bone rank came from the right to assume the throne and marry other members of the sacred bone rank. Sacred bone members were from the royal Kim family that founded the Shilla dynasty. The true bone rank included members of the other royal families that had been conquered by Shilla. True bone rank could become full ministers. So head rank people were descended from sacred or true bone men and lower ranked concubines. They could hold positions like deputy minister, and you had only other jobs in government.
But what happens if, like, I don't know, you had a baby genius and, oh no, sorry, you're just of the head rank. So, no, I feel like this person should be true bone and should be my prime minister or whatever. Was it super rigid like that? There was no chance of any sort of by merit or by ability.
It's interesting that you bring that up because that ends up becoming one of the points that ends up dissolving the system because they wrote it down and it was very codified. It developed as a larger form of social control as the Shilla kingdom expanded and grew more complex. And it was a handy way to absorb other royal families without having to give power to them. So I could still recognize you as a ruler, but because you're not of the highest form in the bone rank caste, I don't actually have to let you rule. So because you're not from the original descendant kind of thing, the sacred bone.
Yeah, you're not even on the same tree as us. You are below.
So in 520, the bone rank system was formalized into law. The royal Kim family did not have any sacred bone males available to take the throne in 632 and 647. So sacred bone women became Queen Sondok and Queen Jindok, respectively. When the next male ascended the throne, he amended the law to allow either sacred or true bone royals to become king because that was that whole, we don't have a man, but we have these women. So it had to do with that push-pull of what was more important to you, having this caste system, this bone rank system still be in place, but then that means I'm going to have a lady ruler, or do I want to open it up so I don't have to have a lady ruler?
I just read the back of the book, right, in terms of the historical note. Mm-hmm. But seeing at a certain point, like, they just weren't having children, too, as well.
Well, and that's because you get a smaller and smaller pool of who's available. Because if you have to be with someone who's in your bone rank class in order for your child to do whatever it is that they're supposed to do, you get very limited options.
Limited options. And then probably there isn't a lot of diversity in the DNA, too, as well, which probably also caused a slew of problems.
100%. And then to your earlier point about like how codified and rigid this was, it was pretty rigid. But over time, many head rank six bureaucrats grew increasingly frustrated with the system. They were in the halls of power every day, but their caste prevented them from attaining high office. Nonetheless, the Shilla kingdom was able to conquer the two other Korean kingdoms to create the unified Shilla kingdom. Over the course of the 9th century, they suffered from weak kings and increasingly powerful and rebellious local lords from head rank 6. In 935, unified Shilla was overthrown by the Hokuryo kingdom, which actively recruited these able and willing head rank 6 men to staff its military and bureaucracy. The bone rank system that the Shilla rulers invented to control the populace and firm up their own hold on power ended up undermining the entire later kingdom.
Oh, you mean that rigid system of hierarchy and control backfired spectacularly? I'm so surprised.
Because the people who actually had skills and abilities were being pigeonholed and kept into a certain place by arbitrary BS rules, and then they got fed up and went somewhere else?
Or, you know, they're not going and getting paid a living wage and they don't want to go and work in cities anymore, so they'll just go and quit their jobs because they want to keep on working from home? Yes.
Oh, sorry. This is not a workers' rights podcast. Thank you. That was door number two. Back to Queen Sondok. So during her 15 years on the throne,
I feel like, sorry, just really quick. It's like we're almost like opening up like an advent calendar.
It's and I'm like, what's behind this door?
It's like, making our way to Christmas.
Is it that? Or in my mind, I was very much like imagining that Price is Right type of game show where it's, do you want door number two? It's the bone ring system. Da-da-da-da.
Full confession, though, I've never seen a full episode of The Price is Right, and I still have no idea how it worked. And I don't think I ever really want to learn. There are just some things I don't need to know in my life.
I don't know what to say about it. You've never had the pleasure and the awkward feeling of Bob Barker telling you to spay and neuter your pet?
No.
Oh.
No, I really don't want to have that now. Thanks.
You're welcome. Okay.
Door number three. Back to Sondok.
Back to Sondok. So, during her 15 years on the throne, Queen Sondok used skillful diplomacy to form stronger alliances with Tang China. The implicit threat of Chinese intervention helped ward off attacks from Shilla rivals. Yet the queen was not afraid to send out her army as well. In addition to external affairs, Sondok was able to encourage alliances with the leading families. She arranged marriages between the families of Taizong the Great and General Kim Yu-sin, a powerful bloc that would later lead to unify the Shilla kingdom and end the Three Kingdoms period. The queen was interested in Buddhism, which was fairly new to Korea at the time, but already was the state religion. As a result, she sponsored temple construction near Gangju in 634. The 80-meter tall Huan Yi Yon Sa pagoda included 9 stories, which represented each one of Shilla's enemies: Japan, China, Shanghai, Tangji, Anzhu, Manchuria, Danguk, Yozhuk, and Yamik, another Manchurian population associated with the Northern Kingdom. They're all depicted on the pagoda until the Mongolian invaders burned it down in 1238. In terms of a statement piece, I'm building a tower that shows how all the rival kingdoms are just stacked on top of each other, but I am on the very top.
I really appreciate that level of power move.
That's how you do it. 80 meters tall. That's quite a feat of engineering.
Exactly. Like, what did they build? It's like, they built a lot, okay?
They've done a lot. So, door number three, astronomy in Korea.
Oh, I'm excited about this.
Okay. Aside from China, Korea is the country with the longest history of astronomy in the world. To meet the need for astronomical almanac to assist agriculture, Korea's ancestors developed astronomical observatories and instruments for studying the celestial bodies and left behind many historical artifacts and a rich heritage. Although these inheritances have disappeared or were destroyed due to many foreign invasions and wars, many artifacts of Korea's historical astronomical heritage still are preserved. charts, observatories, records from various periods of the country's history. Korea's historical books include around 25,000 records on astronomical observations based on Korean steady and systematic observation of the skies over the course of two millennia. So these records of astronomical observation are not only significant for historians, but they're also employed as important data in contemporary astronomical research. So scientists now will actually use what they did from these ancient documents with their modern instruments, and then they recognize that they were accurate in their predictions and what they were graphing and reporting. Using modern day science techniques, they got it. They did it right.
I have this idea that because, we have more sophisticated equipment, or we have the computers that can do it for us. No, human beings have been able to go and do incredible feats. I mean, they had human calculators at NASA, for God's sakes.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's like even how in Egypt, they ascertained that the earth was round in the 2nd century BCE.
So what's really interesting too is that these records provide critical clues on studies of stellar explosions, comet orbits, and abnormal astronomical phenomenon that took place in the past. And they also can be utilized to predict what's happening in the future. So Korea's historical astronomy proves that Korea's outstanding scientific achievements of the past are research for contemporary astronomers, and the study of historical astronomy is now being recognized as a significant part in the new study. Instead of viewing it, oh, that's in the past, it's we are continuing the work forward. It's all still the same study.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of great that way. His official history book of the Three Kingdoms period is a representative text that contains 240 records of astronomical phenomenon, including solar lunar eclipses, planetary movements, meteors, showers, sunspots. By applying these numerical algorithms in relation to celestial bodies, it's been verified that these records are factual from the astronomical phenomenon that these texts contain. And they verify this also with the records that they found in China and in Japan.
Unless you're like the mean ambassador in this book. Who is just a dick.
I'm really grateful that he got his comeuppance, and I'm also, what prudence of this young lady to save face for her father instead of being, I told you, Dad.
I know,
don't believe this clown.
Which on one hand is definitely, I see that you got your clown shoes on and we're squeaking, but I'm going to go and save you.
Oh my God, I just imagine the person dressing themselves in the clown is like, I am the royal astronomer. Like, there is no eclipse.
Yeah, exactly.
I am the clown.
But speaking of astronomy, can we talk about astronomy as a topic and then how it develops some of the book's themes?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, just really quick, Julie, what's the difference between like topic and a theme? A topic is astronomy. A theme is the role of observation of natural phenomena versus inference. That is a theme within the text. Or the role of chasing one's personal interest area, but then going against familial obligations, but then how they can both eventually be reconciled in the end, because you need to be true to yourself to go and be the person who the family needs. And that's manifested through astronomy in terms of Sondok.
But then I just think about a theme, which is in A Christmas Story, and he decides to write about wanting that BB gun, and she essentially gives him a fail.
Yeah, you'll shoot your eye out.
You'll shoot your eye out, but really what she should have said is, that's a topic, not a theme.
Exactly. Anyways, it's sort of how we were talking about with the other books, how there always is something that is really progressing the journey or that is really underpinning, where either you go and you have Marie Antoinette, it's that she's going to Versailles, she's the only thing that she knows, and she's going into this new strange place, to Cleopatra, and you need to go on this journey, and then she becomes an adult, and all the changes that she goes under. Point is, like, their own personal transformations and journeys, but then you go and you have people like the Mary Queen of Scots book, where it's up. So we're working towards this confirmation. What's going on? How does this tie or anything?
Yeah, there isn't really a journey, so to speak. So
personal or physical.
Yeah, see, it's kind of like with Queen Victoria.
Yeah.
Like, even with her, because it's the same thing, she's prepping for her exam with the bishops.
Mm-hmm.
But then she just gives her snappy, very cheeky Queen Victoria replies. But other than that, there isn't really any substantial growth or change. Whereas in this book, genuinely, genuinely, she has her very personal interest and love of studying the stars, and she has her own instruments, and she keeps saying to her dad, maybe this will be the year I'll get my own observatory, like, mm-hmm. fingers crossed. And then she's clashing against the Chinese ambassador, who is very, women should be seen and not heard, and don't deal with this astronomy stuff. I'll predict the eclipse. What do you know?
Yeah. And then Lord Lin Fang. You already read a character and you're just like, I can't stand them. I'm just going to forget everything about them. That's where he's at in my mind.
Yeah. Yeah. And then her dad is sort of put in this very awkward position of, okay, I can't badmouth and tell the person who's representing our ally to just go away and shut up.
Yeah.
But I can't at the same time just ignore my heir. But then Sondok just takes it upon herself to just say, I've embarrassed my dad, so I'll like stop doing this nonsense.
But I think that's part of the book, though. To be the best version of yourself that's going to go and help people, that's going to go and actually do the right thing by your family, you need to be true to who you are as a person.
Sort of like the end credit song in the cartoon version of Mulan, sung by 98 Degrees.
Oh my God.
True to yourself. You must be true to your heart.
Okay, but actually though, because Sondok, the moment that she says, okay, I'm going to bury these instruments, I'm not going to do them anymore, I'm going to be the dutiful Confucian daughter, and she does that for a period of time, and then suddenly like her life starts imploding because her mom's getting sent away and her friend's been sent away, and this whole thing is that then you realize, though, she's not being true to who she is, and her dad's not doing the same thing as well. They're not following the way how they're supposed to be.
Well, who they really are as people.
Yeah.
Her dad is choosing duty mm-hmm. to set aside his wife to have a younger woman so that he can hopefully make a son, because that's what you have to do as a duty.
Mm-hmm.
But genuinely, he probably doesn't want to do this. Well, at least in this book, he seems like he genuinely cares about his Sondok's mother
mm-hmm.
and he doesn't want to have to do that.
But he decides to go and do it because he's not being true to himself. Also, one final thing before we tie this back to astronomy.
Yes.
Is that I do appreciate, too, by the way, that Sondok's stepmom is not demonized or made into a bad person.
No.
Because that would have been a really easy, but fundamentally a very cheap artistic choice that the writer could have done. But there was a choice not to go and do that, and I appreciated that.
Yeah, they showed her to be just as much of a pawn at the whims of this person
mm-hmm.
that the mother was originally. She wasn't scheming to take over from the mom. She doesn't have a choice. Basically, the marriage is brokered between her father and the emperor, and like, that's that.
Yeah. Anyways, because Sondok, in her exploration of the stars, is seeking the truth and following her passion, true to herself. So that's part of its themes, and that's what astronomy goes and tells us, and I'm doing a really bad wrap-up job. I really, really love this book. I'm holding it right now against my chest, being like, I love you so much.
It is accurate. The astronomical system of the era are images found in these tombs that have been preserved. It's sort of an acknowledgement and understanding of when you die as becoming a celestial being
mm-hmm.
or the importance of the stars playing in shaping lives and mm-hmm. shaping death as well. So the fact that constellations showing the positioning of the Big Dipper and Sagittarius respectively in the north and south on the Korean Peninsula are what are depicted on the walls in this particular tomb. That's still being preserved from the Shilla Kingdom. This is interesting to your point of how this is a thing that is about her and her character, and it's talked about a lot, but what is Korea's role in the sort of history of astronomy? And I would say they're one of the leading nations in that history
mm-hmm.
and continuation of that science. So closing that door,
okay.
Back to Queen Sondok. Near the end of her reign, Queen Sondok faced a challenge from Shilla nobleman called Lord Bidam. Sources are sketchy, but he likely rallied supporters under the motto, "Women rulers cannot rule the country." It doesn't really ring true, but it doesn't sound far off from the other tweets and bumper stickers that we've seen whenever a woman tries to have any political power.
True.
The story goes that a bright falling star convinced Bidam's followers that the queen, too, would fall soon. See celestial bodies?
Mm-hmm.
In response, Queen Sondok flew a flaming kite to show that her star was back in the sky. Just 10 days, according to the memoirs of a Shilla general, Lord Bidam and 30 of his co-conspirators were captured. The rebels were executed by her successor 9 days after the queen's own death. So
10 days and then 9 days and she died. I'm like, whoa, back up. Give me a timeline here.
So it's more about just the snapshot about this guy's revolt because I wanted us to go into another door, which is the role of women in Korea in the pre-Chosun era.
Okay.
Because I don't know about you. I don't know a lot about the role of women in Korea around this time. So
yeah. I only know about the role of women in ancient China, and that is very different.
Yeah, very much so. So the Silla Kingdom granted women considerable rights. Women were not solely viewed as secondary citizens. Many women made considerable political and domestic contributions. Unlike later periods, Silla women were not confined to homes. They largely contributed to the tax and labor force, and lower and middle class women, regardless of marital status, often worked in agriculture, assisted their male relatives in learning trades. As vital members of the workforce, both men and women were expected to pay taxes until 60. Males and females shared the responsibility of financially supporting families. Lower and middle class men were subject to military conscription, and the wife would serve as head of the household in the husband's absence, exerting control over finances and daily activities within the household. Families subsequently traced both male and female lineage, and a woman could not be divorced for failing to produce a male heir.
What a concept!
Yes. Silla noble women also enjoyed considerable influence. Their education and intelligence enabled them to be important members of court, and some gained main positions of political power. Three women served as rulers, while others achieved influence as royal consorts, concubines, or through the manipulation of their male heirs. Right away, Sondok is not an anomaly. And I think the critical part too is even in the bone rank system that connects to this as well, is that we don't just care about where's the father from. Mm-hmm. We care about the mother's line too.
Yeah.
And if you are in a society that doesn't care about women, you won't need to track that at all. So think about how many women we've talked about when we're thinking we don't know a specific date of when they were born or all this kind of stuff, because mm-hmm. just women don't matter.
Yeah.
But in era and time in Korea, women did matter enough that there was going to be proper documentation of it.
Wild. Absolutely wild.
I know. You guys should have just seen Julia's flipped out face when I was talking about equitable contributions in the workplace and equal taxation until the age of 60.
Paying taxes because we live in a society.
I know.
What a concept.
So Queen Sondok was revered as a just and virtuous ruler. She wasn't evaluated by her gender, but had efficiency and success in her reign. After her death, the throne passed over male relatives and was given to her female cousin. Similar to her cousin, Chindok received loyalty of male generals, officials, and courtiers, and made substantial efforts to fight foreign invaders and improve the infrastructure of the country. The last Silla queen, Chinsong, ruled more than two centuries later. Unfortunately, she inherited a bankrupt dynasty where people were desperate and starving. Other Silla women served as regents, representing husbands from behind the scenes. The significance of this practice indicates respect was held for the mother, and responsibility bestowed indicates that the consensus was women were able to make intelligent political decisions. Wives and concubines held the affectionate ears of the ruler, were also able to influence politics and advocate for issues. The vital presence of Silla women therefore indicates this period of Korean history, women were not seen as delicate, incapable beings, but dependable, important members of society.
Hear, hear.
What a concept.
I know, right?
The Goryeo dynasty from 918 to 1392 initially took a fairly liberal stance on women, but the growing influence of Confucianism ultimately caused the status of women to decline. Bwamp, bwamp. According to records of Chinese traveler Zhu Jing, women and men interacted freely with no laws prohibiting male and female social exchange. Women could also inherit property, and the inheritance was split equally between sons and daughters. If a woman died without children, her possessions would be passed to siblings, as opposed to her husband. The practice of allowing women to inherit is indicative of the relative respect women were regarded with. Like men, they were endowed with enough trust to own property. What? Oof. Marriage, however, was expected by all respectable Goryeo females, and single women were generally looked down upon.
Of course.
Yeah. There's always got to be a catch. While a dowry was desirable, young brides were not required to bring anything but a wardrobe and household supplies they would use. Although the bride's family was expected to pay the substantial cost of the wedding feast and festivities, women were not regarded as burdens who had robbed their families of wealth, but as vital members of their natal family. So unlike I'm very sorry that you have to deal with this daughter. Please take this cow along with her. Instead, yeah. It was, you're gaining a daughter. This is a boon for you.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, widowed women would remain chaste, but many remarried. And in some cases, a widow was permitted to bring her deceased husband's land and wealth as her dowry. The widows of soldiers who died in battle were given government land grant that would support the family, but were expected to return it if they remarried.
Fair enough.
Sheila and Curio treatment of women should not be mistaken to signify that females enjoyed complete freedom or equality. When have women ever experienced complete freedom and equality?
Never.
Never. Women continue to be under the jurisdiction of men and subject to strict behavioral expectations. As time progressed, records show increasingly the number of women being confined in the home and restricted from outside labor. Wealthy women began to be raised upon the ideals of Yuk-ik, a Koryo book that taught women to uphold filial and submissive behavior. Like I said, Confucianism, which had increased in popularity during this period, encouraged the strengthening of mutually exclusive gender roles, and the status of women declined throughout the dynasty.
It's always interesting how that the moment that a social, political philosophy that just goes and boosts men up and, of course, limits women, which then increases men's power, I'm so surprised that it became popular.
Yeah.
So surprised.
We will explore about different religions at this time, but that is something to note for sure.
Mm-hmm.
We are now leaving the door of Korean women and their role in society at this time.
Okay.
Back to Queen Sondok information. Okay. In addition to the story of the poppy seeds in her childhood, further legends about Queen Sondok's predictive abilities have come through the word of mouth and scattered written records. One story is a chorus of white frogs appeared in the dead of winter and croaked ceaselessly in the Jade Gate Pond at the temple. When Queen Sondok heard about their untimely emergence from hibernation, she immediately sent 2,000 soldiers to Woman's Root Valley, west of the capital, where the Sheila troops found and wiped out a force of 500 invaders from the neighboring kingdom.
Nice.
Her courtiers asked the queen how she knew the soldiers would be there, and she replied, frogs represented soldiers, white meant they came from the west, and their appearance at the Jade Gate, a euphemism for female genitalia, told her the soldiers would be in Woman's Root Valley. Another legend preserves the Sheila people's love for the queen. According to this story, a man traveled to the temple to see the queen, who is making a visit there. Unfortunately, he was tired out by the journey and fell asleep while waiting for her. Queen Sondok was touched by his devotion. She gently placed a bracelet on his chest as a sign of her presence. When he awoke and found the queen's bracelet, his heart was full of love. It burst into flames and burned down the entire pagoda.
Oh my god. He self-immolated from love. Wow. Was he really touched to go and meet you? I don't know. He didn't self-immolate.
Yeah, he got swept up with his passion.
It wasn't self-immolation. It was spontaneous combustion. Spontaneous combustion.
It's like, how much do you love this person? Have you ever spontaneously combusted? So, door number 5, spiritual and religious systems in Korea. So in this book, they cover shamanism,
mm-hmm.
there's Buddhism, and then there's Confucianism.
Yes.
So shamanism is what was practiced in pre-Sondok's time. Buddhism is what she practices, and now we have the Chinese ambassador who's coming in with Confucianism.
Mm-hmm.
And so they all sort of play a role, and this is, again, to that point of the story being so well written. They all play a role in that push-pull about being true to yourself, and she buries her instrument. She wants to be following Confucian rules of being a quiet, dutiful woman, girl.
Mm-hmm.
In Buddhism, she has that whole idea about, like, self-sacrifice and becoming your best self and your highest self, and her very close friend decides that he actually wants to become a Buddhist priest.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of is one of those things where he was a real person.
Okay.
They did have a real connection.
Mm-hmm.
And it is one of those things of she never married. He became a priest. They were very, very close. So maybe he was a bit of her Robert Dudley, the one that got away.
The one that got away.
Yeah. So there's that whole potential vein there. And then with shamanism, she wants to reject it because it's primitive and it's not acceptable form of religion or worship.
Mm-hmm.
But when she's pushed to the edge with her mother being replaced, mm-hmm. she consults with the shaman woman,
yes.
to try to reverse fate.
Yeah.
But obviously it doesn't work.
No, because that's one of the better scenes in the book. You've already given him his heir. Like,
yeah.
It's here. She's here right now. And it's true.
It's true. So the woman wasn't wrong. So shamanism is a primitive religion. It doesn't really have a system structure, but it permeates into the daily lives of people through folklore and customs.
Okay, quick question though, because they say shamanism, but we also have shamanism like all over the world though. Is there a specific term, this Korean Peninsula shamanism, or are we just going to call it shamanism for simplicity's sake?
We'll call it shamanism for simplicity's sake, but I will talk about a little bit of how actually a lot of the same beliefs, it is kind of universal. Because and that's sort of how shamanism operates, because it isn't like a formal structured religion in that way. So in the Neolithic, people in Korea had animistic beliefs that every object in the world possessed a soul. So it's the same sort of beliefs that you see in different other types of indigenous groups.
Yeah.
You know, so people believe that we have a soul that never dies. So a corpse was laid in the ground with its head toward the east in the direction of sunrise. Neolithic man believed that while good spirits like the sun would bring good luck, evil spirits would bring misfortune. So a lot of folklore superstition. Shamanism eventually gave way to Confucianism or Buddhism as a tool for governing people, but its influence lingered on. The shaman, the mudang in Korea, is an intermediary who can link the living with the spiritual world where the dead reside. The shaman is considered capable of reverting bad luck, curing sickness, assuring passage from this world to the next. The shaman is also believed to resolve conflicts and tensions that exist between the living and the dead. Korean shamanism includes worships of thousands of spirits and demons believed to dwell in every object in the natural world, in rocks, trees, mountains, streams, and in celestial bodies. The introduction of the more complex and codified religions like Taoism, Confucianism, Buddhism did not result in the abandonment of these beliefs. Instead, they assimilated elements of shamanistic faith and coexisted. The shamanism has remained an underlying religion in the Korean people, as well as a vital aspect to their culture.
Cool. It's kind of like how you have like Santeria, where it's like a mixture of West Africa and Roman Catholicism, and it sort of becomes like its own.
It's its own thing, or it's like, it's still like the same idea of, you know, people still believe in, you know, the pixies or the fairies or something. Don't knock over this milk because then the fairies will come and blah, blah, blah. Oh, it's a fairy circle. Like that kind of stuff. It still is peppered throughout every culture, I think.
Okay, so we have Buddhism here, Taoism here. It's like, we're still going to go and take the elements. And it's saying that like Catholicism went and took a bunch of pagan imagery and just incorporated it into the Catholic Church.
100%. So Buddhism is a highly disciplined philosophical religion that emphasizes personal salvation through rebirth in endless cycles of reincarnation. Buddhism was introduced to Korea in 372 CE by a monk named Sundo, who came from the Qing dynasty in China. In 384, a monk Melanda brought Buddhism to Pekche from the eastern Jin state of China. In Shila, Buddhism was disseminated by a monk Edo of Kokoryo by the mid-5th century. Buddhism seems to be supported by the ruling people of the Three Kingdoms because it was suitable as a spiritual prop for a governing structure, with the Buddha as a single object of worship, like the king is a single object of authority. So it helps to have a monotheistic sort of leaning.
Yeah, even though it's not really, there's no god, but...
No, it's the same idea. You have a figure, and it's one figure.
Yeah.
As opposed to every single rock having a spirit.
And it ends up being, well, if every single rock is a spirit, then every single person has the capability of ruling.
Can't have that.
No, cannot do that, no.
Under royal patronage, many temples and monasteries were constructed, and the believers grew steadily. By the 6th century, monks and artisans were migrating to Japan with scriptures and religious artifacts to form the basis of the early Buddhist culture there. So Buddhism in Japan comes from Korea. By the time the Shilla unified the peninsula in 668, it embraced Buddhism as a state religion, although the government systems were along the Confucian lines. Royal preference for Buddhism in this period produced magnificent flowering of Buddhist arts and temporal architecture, including the Punggut-sun temple and other relics in the capital of Shilla. The state cult of Buddhism began to deteriorate as the nobility indulged in a luxurious lifestyle. Kind of goes against Buddhist principles of, you know, giving up earthly things for enlightenment.
Just a little bit.
Buddhism then established the Sun sect, Japanese Zen, to concentrate on finding universal truth through a life of frugality. So almost in response to that, that's where it became more codified of give up this earthly stuff, like become a higher Zen person.
It's like, I could become a higher Zen person, but I really like all of my face serums.
Yeah, it's like, I could, but I like bath bombs too much. Confucianism was a moral and religious belief founded by Confucius in the 6th century BC. Basically, it's a system of ethical principles, benevolent love, religious righteousness, decorum, and wise leadership, designed to inspire and preserve the good management of family and society. Confucianism was a religion without a god, like early Buddhism. But as ages passed, the sage and principal disciplines were canonized by later followers. Confucianism was introduced along the early specimens of Chinese written materials around the beginning of the Christian era. The Three Kingdoms in Korea all left records that indicate early existence of Confucian influence. In Goguryeo, the state university called Tachekam was established in 372, and private Confucian academics were founded in the province. Pekche set up such institutions even earlier. In unified Shilla, sent delegations of scholars to Tang China to observe the workings of Confucian institutions firsthand to bring back volumes of writing on the subject. For the Koryan dynasty in the 10th century, Buddhism was a state religion. Confucianism formed the philosophical and structural backbone of the state. The civil service examinations adopted the Chinese system in the late 10th century, greatly encouraged the studies of Confucian classics, and deeply implanted Confucian values in Korean minds. So it was just thought to be, this is a better way of governing people as a collective. When we're trying to lay out law and order as a government, it's easier if you're following principles that are like very law and order, black and white.
Well, and also too, is that the underlying theme of Confucianism is that order in the home will then go and reflect order in society. It's not that, oh, we're taking care of everyone. It's everyone else is monitoring each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so they end up doing the work for you in a way.
Yeah, so you don't have to worry about it.
No, because you don't need to go and worry about people rabble-rousing together because they're all going in place. Oh, I saw that you let your wife out of the house sooner, or I saw that you did not go and act with propriety earlier in the week. The whole thing, like, shame ends up becoming a big part of it too.
Saving face, but then it also makes it less about, yes, the individual, but then the individual is part of a family unit.
Yep.
And therefore, if someone in the family unit acts out of line, then that reflects poorly on the whole of the family. And this isn't just Confucianism.
No.
Like, this is all organized religions.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Like, we're not specifically...
This is not talking about Confucianism. We're just talking about how governments like to use religion to keep people in line.
And it will happen, again, anywhere, at any time, any place.
Okay. Closing that door.
Okay. We're back into the main courtyard.
Back into the main courtyard of Sondok. So one day, sometime before her passing, Queen Sondok gathered her courtiers and announced that she would die on January 17th, 647. She asked to be buried in the Tusha Heaven, and her courtiers replied that they didn't know the location, so she pointed at a place, Nagsan, Wolf Mountain. On the exact day she predicted, Queen Sondok died and was interred on a tomb in Nagsan. 10 years later, another Shilla ruler built the Temple of Four Heavenly Kings down the slope from her tomb. They use large burial mounds.
Mm-hmm. I've seen the pictures.
The court later realized they were fulfilling the final prophecy from Sondok, where in Buddhist scripture, the four heavenly kings live below the Tushia heaven on Mount Meru.
Obviously, she predicted her death, and this is not to go make light of it, but I wonder if it was, oh my god, we're getting to the end of the day and I haven't died yet. Or it's kind of like Elizabeth I, I'm going to be standing, it's been 3 days, you haven't died yet. She's like, and then, yeah.
And then she was like, I guess I'll just die.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. Or maybe, I think if anything, this lady, she's very self-possessed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if she makes a commitment, she keeps it.
Yep.
So Queen Sondok never married or had children. In some versions of the Poppy legend, it suggests that the Tang Emperor teased Sondok about her lack of offspring when he sent the painting of the flowers, no bees or butterflies.
Ooh.
As her successor, Sondok chose her cousin Kim Sungmin, who became Queen Jindok. The fact that another ruling queen followed immediately after her reign proves that she was an able and astute ruler. Lord Bidem's protestations notwithstanding. Remember, he was the guy who wanted to overthrow her, and in that time, she crushed him, but then she dies,
mm-hmm.
and then he and his people are executed by her successor, aka her cousin.
Yeah.
She takes care of it.
After Sondok goes and says, you bitch, you fought!
Her fire kite? I need an illustration of that.
Yeah. Let's make that into, like, a new thing. Like, I set up up a fire kite.
I'm sending out my fire kite. So the Shilla Kingdom would also boast Korea's third and final ruler, Queen Jinsong, nearly 200 years later from 887 to 897. So the thing about Sondok, which I think is really important to understand, is that she's a remarkable person, but she's also not an anomaly. She's actually a wonderful example of look what can happen when, instead of just saying, I guess this is a weird thing, we'll make the girl the ruler. Mm-hmm. It was just, no, she's going to be the ruler. Mm-hmm. And so she was set up to succeed. And then what was great too is, especially how this was, I found, illustrated in the book, is that idea of being true to yourself and coming into your own. I think that she was able to do that in real life too, because she was assumed to be capable, and therefore she was. Mm-hmm. Instead of having to fight against everybody saying this is impossible, no one's ever done this before.
Exactly.
So that is Queen Sondok and our travels through many doors in Korea.
I learned a lot, but I'm also like, I'm so sad to leave this book behind. It's also just beautiful too.
You can always reread it, you know.
I know. Ugh.
You know how you're supposed to never say that you actually have a favorite child?
Yeah.
But secretly, I kind of like this one a little itch more.
Yeah, this one is...
This book is a little itch more. Yeah. I almost would say to someone, if, you know, there are those entry-level women that you've heard about, most people probably haven't heard of Sondok. And I would say, if you've read the books where you think, oh, I know Marie Antoinette, I know, take a leap and read the Sondok one. Mm-hmm. Because it's actually the best book. It's so well-written. It's so well-done.
It is. And I'm really sad that this is the only book by this woman in the whole series.
Yes.
I feel that if she wrote even more, it'd be amazing.
Yeah.
No offense, but also full offense to all the other books out there.
You can't just end with, like, no offense to the other books.
But, I mean, listen. Okay, I'm kind of clowning just a bit on them. I'm saying clown a lot recently. But anyways, the point is, Sondok, frickin' a slap till the end of time.
Such a good book.
Follow us for more research, fun facts, soundtracks, and aesthetic posts. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Twitter at Royal Diaries Pod.